tuned into Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Tune in right now.
What's going on, my beautiful people? It's Thursday, you know what that means. Another great day here inside the Black Actors Studio. I'm your host, Danny Royce, and joining me today in the studio is an amazing, talented director and producer. I produced and directed the award-winning four-part series, Black is the New Black, and also one of UK's 100 most influential Black people alongside the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle. Great pleasure to have him in the studio. I'd like to welcome the Black Actors Studio. Is very proud to have Simon Frederick. What's up, and how are you?
I'm very well.
Great to have you in here.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. How are you today?
I'm good. Yeah, excited to be here.
Good. I'm glad you are. I'm excited to have you. So first, I want to congratulate you on They've Gotta Have Us. All right, the series. I mean, I was just reading the synopsis and all that. It's actually really incredible, and I'm so excited to have you here in the studio because that's the basis of what this show was built on. You know, it just bringing light to our people and the history and our amazingness, our blackness, right? So I want to ask you, what was like one of the first things that came to your mind about creating this series?
It's exactly what you said. Mm-hmm. We're exceptional.
Yes.
You know, it's like I grew up watching exceptional performances from, you know, incredible artists. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was a kid seeing, you know, like those great Roman films, you know. And there was this black guy that was in this film. Mm-hmm. And this guy was like built, you know, like... like, you know, like a muscle man.
Right.
But he was beating white people, you know, and I just thought, there's a guy that's winning, you know, and he was a great actor. His name was Willie Strode.
Yes.
You know, and Willie Strode was an amazing actor, but he was the first person that really stood out to me. Mm-hmm. I just kept seeing these performances after performances after performances of really, you know, superb people. And I'm, you know, and then... you get to see like Trading Places and, yes. you know, and Eddie Murphy being Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just thought that was amazing because here was a black man walking through the white world and him being unapologetically black.
Mm.
And that really inspired me.
That's awesome. We're going to talk a lot more about They've Gotta Have Us later on in the show. But here in the studio, we'd like to start off at the beginning. Where were you born?
Okay, I was born in London.
Nice.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to be telling you the truth of my background.
Okay. From the accent, right? How was the dynamics in your household?
Well, when I was, say, for about the age of six, mm-hmm. until I was about nine, I spent most of that time in Grenada.
Mm.
And that was incredible, you know, because... growing up in a black country, you know, everyone's black.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Yes, it's a colonialized country. It comes from colonial past. So you're aware of racism, but you don't encounter it every day.
Mm.
I remember when I went back to London and being in what we call junior school.
Okay.
And I remember reading this book and they asked me to read a passage. And I had this Grenadian accent, and so I can't remember the full passage, but it was like the man confronted the skeleton, and the teacher said to me, "Fredericks, spell skeleton," and I spelt skeleton, but then I kept reading it as skeleton, and he sent me out of the class.
Really?
Yeah, and I couldn't understand why he was sending me out of the class, but he felt that I was, you know. Can I swear on here? Or?
Drop it.
Okay. He felt that I was taking the piss.
Okay.
Yeah. And okay. I wasn't. You know, so that made me realize when I got a bit older and I started to challenge the status quo in school,
mm-hmm.
I realized that my teachers were not culturally aware.
Right.
And I think that that's something which is, you know, living in the Western world.
Of course.
It doesn't matter whether I live in England or I live in America. And trust me when I say, you know, there's a lot of people here who really believe that that in Britain we don't have racism. We have had just as bad racism that as you guys have had here. Mm-hmm. You know, we've had a civil rights movement which has followed the American civil rights movement, mm-hmm. but we have been beaten, we have been chased, we've been bitten by dogs. You know, we've had all of that. You know,
right.
My parents went to the United Kingdom in the 60s. And when they arrived there, there were signs on windows saying, no blacks, no Irish, no dogs. Mm. You know, so, you know, they'd go and rent a room and they'd turn up and they'd be told that there were no more spaces.
Right.
You know, somebody white turns up, they could rent the room, you know.
Right.
So it really was not an easy time growing up in England in like the 70s and the 80s. It was quite difficult.
I mean, just to be, you know, compared to a dog, like what is, you know, like that's crazy. But we've come a long way. We still have a long way to go. I do want to touch on just a moment about Meghan Markle and Harry and that whole leaving the line, so to speak. What are your thoughts on that?
It's an interesting question. I did a radio interview in London about this, and I said, look, I'm not coming on here to talk about Harry and Meghan and mm-hmm. their decision because I don't know them.
Yes.
Yeah, and I don't know what the basis of their decision is,
okay.
really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But from my observation, has the media been racist towards her? Well, hell yeah.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and, you know, when I've spoken to my white colleagues and friends about this, I just say to them, this is really simple, yeah? When you were growing up, yeah, if you brought home a person of color to and said to them, this is someone I'm going to marry, what would they say?
Hmm. Right, yeah? Right.
They would be concerned that because in their minds they had this vision that yep. you know that you know we do it in a black community
yeah
you know so mm-hmm. it's something you know so my thing is always break it down to its fundamentals
yes.
yeah
correct
what I do believe is that happened though is that I think that when the wedding happened the whole world was happy for them
mm-hmm.
then when they had the child
that part.
Yeah. She put up brick walls,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And I think that if you're going into the queen is a matriarch in this environment,
yeah.
It's like going into any family, okay. And you have you know your mother or grandmother is your matriarch, you know she's the leader
correct.
Of your family,
right.
And then you bring in you know your new partner and your new wife, and she wants to be the matriarch straight away. Yeah, it causes disturbance.
Yes.
Yeah, and I think that Meghan didn't do herself any favors. She had the public on her side, but then she did things where the public, you know, basically became turned off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that fundamentally has been a problem as well. And the last point I think with Meghan is Harry has come out and publicly said that he believes the treatment of his wife has been racist,
right.
But we've never heard Meghan come out and publicly say it. And if she hasn't said it, it means that people can continually say that it's not racist because she hasn't said it.
Mm. Yeah. That's a very good point. So growing up, what were some of the shows or any influential filmmakers that really, really wanted you to get into this industry?
I didn't want to get into this industry. I had no aspirations to become an artist or a filmmaker
okay.
or a photographer.
Okay.
I thought that was something that other people did,
uh-huh.
you know, that were far more talented than me, far you know, far better looking than me, far richer than me. You know, I know you're not agreeing with that, but
hey, not at all.
Yeah. but that's what I believed.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it wasn't something that really was on my radar, but
okay.
at the same time, I admired those people. You know, I really felt that I had an affinity for filmmakers. You know, when when John Singleton made Boys in the Hood.
Yes.
Yeah, I love classic. I loved that film.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I heard he was 19 when he made it, you know, it was like I couldn't believe that there was this guy with similar ages, and you know, I know what I was doing at 19.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I wasn't writing scripts. Yeah.
Right.
So, you know, it's like it was awe-inspiring. You mm-hmm. know, but then I just thought that they were. These people were superhuman. I thought they were on a completely different plane.
Right. You thought it was kind of like unattainable.
Because I think that for black people, for black kids, even for working class white kids,
mm-hmm.
We're not told that, you know, when you go to school, no one ever tells you what you really could be, or no one ever asks you what you would like to be.
Right.
Yeah. Right. All that happens is you go through a school system, and it churns you out at the end.
Yeah.
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 And that's it.
Definitely. Yeah. What did you get into after school? Like, what profession did you find yourself in?
Sorry, can I blow it?
Yes, go right in. No worries. We could. This is pre-taped, so we can take that
sure.
out.
Yep. I gathered that.
So I'm going to re-ask the question.
Okay.
You know? So what was some of the professions that you found yourself getting into after school?
Well, actually, during school, from a very young age, I was always drawing. I always used to draw.
Nice.
My West Indian father, you know, who was... You know, really wanted me to have a career and be safe in an unsafe England.
It
was like, you know, get a book, you know, read books,
right.
you know, do maths, get a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he wasn't really keen on me drawing, but my mum really encouraged it, you know, and my mum passed away some years ago, but I always give, you know, praise to her, because I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for her understanding that you know, I think that in the black community, it's really important that we as parents allow our children to dream.
Yes.
And we don't kill our children's dreams.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And my mum allowed me to be a dreamer. I remember I went on holiday to Grenada.
Mm-hmm.
And when I arrived in my grandmother's house, my grandmother had framed all these pictures that I had drawn that my mum had sent to her in Grenada.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like it just melted my heart as a kid.
Wow.
You know, that my grandmother was the first person to put my art up on her walls.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's such an incredible feeling. It's interesting also that you brought up about the dreams and not, you know, killing, especially in our community. Do you find that that's happening? I mean, maybe in the past it's happened a lot more, but now, do you think that's something that's really prevalent, or that we're kind of getting away from that?
I think we're getting away from that because we're in this social media type world where anyone can be an entrepreneur if they really want to be.
Right.
And that's a wonderful thing. But I think back in the day, there was a certain generation of parents who... They, you know, if you said to them, look, I want to be a filmmaker or I want to be an artist, they were like, what?
Yeah, what is that?
what is that?
Yeah.
I want to go to art school. What do you want to do that for? Would you want to go and smoke weed and,
you
know, and laze around? No, there are careers in these things, but they didn't know about this stuff. You know, their education about these careers were very limited or non-existent.
Right.
You know, so I think to a certain extent, you know, our generation has educated our parents in terms of possibility. My dad is completely different now, fully supportive of my career, loves it. You know, will tell everyone, you know, my son have a show on Netflix, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Now he's like, yes, I got it.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's amazing. But when did you make that transition to like, okay, I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to, you know, you said John Singleton was someone that you kind of, that kind of caught your eye with Boys in the Hood. When did you make that decision? Or I'm going to go into filmmaking. I'm going to give my artistry a try.
Okay. So I was 38 when I picked up a camera, started taking pictures, which is late. And when I got to 40, I had quite a successful career in communications. And I went to my partners and said, I'm leaving. And they thought I was crazy. I made a portfolio, spent about a year making a portfolio, and I went around to a lot of people who were my clients or people that I had employed and showed them that portfolio. And they all said to me, don't do it. You're not good enough. You know, don't do this.
Wow.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe it's the stubborn side of me, from come way back from the ancestors, that got us through slavery. I just followed what I followed my instincts. I followed what I believed was the right path for me.
That's awesome.
But there was a transition because I was a music photographer.
Okay.
And I've worked with some, I've photographed many bands and artists around the world, big name people, whatever. And some people would say to me, it's like, that was a really great session. You should shoot my music video. And I would say to them, I'm not a director. And I said that for years because I really did believe that to become a director, I needed to go to film school. I needed to study the art. I needed to understand the craft.
Okay.
And I couldn't just pick up a camera and say, I am a director.
Yeah.
But then I started to shoot the odd music video. And I remember shooting a music video for a young guy called Calvin Colt, who's German. And he's now become like a huge megastar in Germany and across the world, certain parts of the world as well. And it was a friend of mine, Savannah Giesler. I'm going to give Savannah a call out.
Yeah,
Savannah is quite a high-profile producer. She works with a director called Johann Renk.
Okay.
And they did the music videos, last music videos for when David Bowie died.
Oh,
they made all those videos.
Wow, okay.
And she said to me, metaphorically speaking, you need to come out of the closet with your directing.
Yes.
Yeah, because you are making stuff for people who... you're doing it for little or no money, and you're making magic out of stuff. So go and direct. And it was her forthrightness and slight bullying that I decided that I was going to, try my hand at this.
So, that's amazing.
Yeah, that's how I began.
That's how you began. And I want to talk about Black is the New Black. So tell us about the start of that. Where'd you get the idea of creating the 4-part series?
Very similar to creating this. Mm-hmm. Again, frustration. I'm living in England. I'm reading the newspapers, and it's constantly telling me that in the Black community is a failing community, educationally, financially, all of these things.
Mm-hmm.
But yet I look around me and I see talent.
Yeah.
You know, Naomi Campbell is a world star.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are other people who are doing stuff. And it's across the board in science, in literature.
Everything.
In everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's just Brits. I'm even talking about, over here.
Yeah.
And so I got really frustrated at that fact that we were being seen through a lens. And that lens was not showing us in a favorable light.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going to... My mom used to take me... Sorry, I need to blow my nose again.
This is terrible. No worries. Let's see. Where did you... If you can just remember that thought and then you say it, though.
Yeah, I remember. I'm a director. I remember cues.
There you go.
I was going to make a Tyler Perry joke. Then.
Save that. We might throw that in. No.
So I remember when I was younger, my mum took me to the National Portrait Gallery, and I had a fascination for those portraits. I couldn't tell you today why.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, at that young age, I just was interested in staring at those portraits. But they communicated to me in some way. I love the artistry of it.
Of course.
So when I got older, I remember walking around the gallery and thinking to myself, if this gallery is the, I gave it a nickname, and the nickname was the family album of our nation's achievers.
Wow.
Where were the cousins in this? And I kept walking around. And then I remember reading this phrase, and it's a really powerful phrase, that you can tell the history of a nation by the people it chooses to put up on its walls. That's deep.
Wow, that is.
Yeah.
That is.
So I was like, something needs to be done about this. So I sent an email to the then director of the National Portrait Gallery, a man by the name of Sandy Nairn. And to my surprise, he answered and agreed to a meeting. And I came in. I hadn't shot anything. It was just an idea. And you don't go to these people with
right,
an idea.
With just an idea.
my naivety. And I went in and told him. And he said, look, if you can do this, bring the pictures here. We have a selection process. It may not be that we take them, but go ahead. It's a great idea. So I started to call people that I knew. I started to call people that I knew who knew other people. And I started to... So Black is New Black was meant to be just an exhibition.
Okay.
So when I started photographing people, get them in the studio and we're photographing, they're talking to me and they're telling me about what's going on in their lives, in their careers. And a lot of people were really struggling. You know, they felt that they were the... They're having this career and they are one black person living in a silo in the media industry. And they were finding that their career progression, they were having to maneuver their career progression, you know, in certain ways to get by.
Right.
You know, just to get the next job, just to get the next promotion, whatever that was. Yeah. And that was difficult. And I kept hearing the same thing from everyone that I photographed. And I kept thinking, do they not speak to each other? Because it's like going to the doctor and thinking you're the only one who has that symptom.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very true.
So it was at that point I realized that I couldn't be the only person hearing these stories. I needed to bring all those people together under one umbrella and get them talking about their stories. I'd never made a documentary before. I'd never really filmed anything on that level.
Right.
I'd never had to sit down and write, you know, a structure that had an arc that took you on a journey and made points, or had a thesis basis to it.
Right.
You know, so it was a really steep learning curve. And then the other thing was that Black is the New Black has no narration in it. And it also has no archive clips. So it's literally just those people talking
just
on screen.
Raw. Yeah. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
But what I wanted to do was to do things which I saw that frustrated me. So, for example, we're talking to each other here. We're having a conversation. There are cameras around us, but we're not talking to our audience.
Yeah.
We're talking to each other.
Right, great.
And I wanted to break that. I wanted to allow the audience to be the most important people within this transaction.
Gotcha.
Okay. So that those people were talking, the people on screen are talking directly to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what they did with me when we were on camera. I need to blow my nose again.
Correct. No, you're good. Yeah, man. Yeah. You and me both. I just got out.
I remember the. So it's
his mic. Okay, I can't hear. Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
You're good.
Those people on screen, I wanted them to have a direct relationship with the audience. And I remember going into the BBC and I shot a little pilot, and there was the pilot was with Tiny Temper. I don't know if you know Tiny Temper. And Tiny said two things which blew the commissioners at the BBC away. The first thing he said was that he was proud to be black. And one of the commissioners black herself.
Okay.
And she'd never heard another black person in Britain saying that they were proud to be black and British.
Man, that's crazy.
Because usually in Britain, there was this thing where black people would say, you know, if their parents were Nigerian, they say, I'm Nigerian. Or if your parents are Grenadian, you say, I'm Grenadian.
It's, right.
You know, but you never identified with being English or Scottish or Welsh or whatever. But he said he identified with that. And the other thing that he identified with, which was really stunning, because it proved that we as black people we don't really understand our own diversity.
No, that is very true.
Yeah, and also, you know, I don't think white people understand our diversity either.
No.
But they don't care. But we don't really understand our diversity, because he says something profound. In Black History Month in England, which is in November, by the way, in schools, all they teach you about is slavery.
Yes.
Which I believe is the same here.
Correct.
Yeah. So he went home and he said to his mum, Mum, were we slaves?
Mm.
And she said, have you lost your mind? And he said, well, at school, it's Black History Month, and they're saying that we're slaves. And she says, listen, your father is from Nigeria. His father is from Nigeria. His father was from Nigeria. And his father was from Nigeria. We were never slaves.
Mm.
Yeah? Not all of us, not all black people were slaves or went through slavery.
Correct, yeah.
And that is really a profound thought. And when we presented that, they were like, wow, this is amazing.
Mm.
But you can't make it. You can't make the show like that. You know, we don't make television this way.
Yeah.
And I said, that's the way I'm going to make it, or I'm not going to make it at all.
There you go.
So they said to us, okay, if you could prove to us that it would work, you know, give us an example of something that works in a same kind of format. And if your answer is good enough, we'll commission it. So I thought for a second, I thought, actually, there is something. There's a radio show in England. It's been on, I'm not sure if it's 50 or 60 years, this radio show's been on. Every year its audience grows. Yeah,
wow.
And it's a radio play. It's a drama. Yeah,
wow.
I can't see the characters. Yeah, I don't know anything about their locations, because it's just voice.
Right.
So I said, yeah, there's a show called The Archers. It's just voice. Yeah, and in mine, you're able to see the people.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't argue against that, so they commissioned it.
Wow.
Yeah.
What's one of the would you say one of your biggest challenges? In doing this series, and I mean, they've got to have us. What was one of your biggest challenges you ran into as a filmmaker?
Being black.
Yes, that takes the cake.
99.9% of people who work in television or work in film will never have the chance to work with a black director.
Wow, that is a large percentage.
And when you walk on set, so I walk on set first day, and I was talking about this earlier. I shot my pilot, and I had a team, and I knew what everyone did. And I was told that as this was being commissioned, that the broadcaster would surround me with talent, okay, or surround me with experience, and I'd be the talent. And what I ran into there was a lot of people telling me, and this happens in television a lot, where if you are new to television, those people who have 2, 3, 4, 10, 20, 30, 40 years experience, they feel like they're veterans in the army.
Right.
They have stripes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So they will tell you that, we don't do that in television. We don't do it that way. We don't, you know, we do it this way. No, that's a great idea, but that will never work.
Right.
Yeah. And you can do two things. You can defer your responsibility to them, okay, and take on board what they do and let them lead you, yeah, and compromise your idea.
Right.
Or you can be like me, stubborn. And you say, no, listen, it's like, I wrote this thing. Yeah?
Yeah.
I understand what all the problems are, because basically I wrote, in creating the idea, the first thing you work out is what the problems are.
Right.
And then you eliminate those. So all you're left with is what I call the sweet spots. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm going to stick with that because I know intrinsically what I'm doing. Also, I was making something that people had, they hadn't seen that before on television.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those guys who had experience, they were coming at it from the same point of view. We were all at a starting point because none of us had made this before. Yeah.
Yeah.
So really, the struggle was one, being a black director and not being respected by white colleagues. And the other thing was the lack of experience that they had in terms of this idea that I was, you know, my idea, I knew my idea. And basically, I was the only experienced person in that room at that point because it was my idea.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, those were the difficulties.
Wow. So you have, I mean, there's a lot of contributors to They've Gotta Have Us.
Yeah.
You know, Barry Jenkins, Jesse Williams. I mean, the list goes on. It's really amazing. Don Cheadle. How was getting these people on board? How was that process for you?
So we first made this this TV show with the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
And when they commissioned it, they were, look, this is great, but will you get those people? Because anyone who's made television knows that people will pitch an idea and they'll come with this long list.
Yeah.
They'll resurrect the dead and put it on their list.
Right.
So people make big promises, and a lot of people have made, you know, still make shows today. They promise the world. Okay, and when you see what they actually deliver, it's like it's completely different.
Completely, right. Yeah.
We don't get to do that, though.
Mm-hmm.
If we say that we're going to deliver Naomi Campbell or whoever it is, if I said I was going to deliver, you know, Harry Belafonte, I had to. Otherwise, yeah. They were going to look at me, and it didn't matter who else I had. They were going to say, you didn't deliver this guy. Mm-hmm. You failed.
Yeah. Mm.
So, we were worried about it. I was worried about it because most of the contributors list is American. They don't know me.
Right.
They, you know, didn't know my work. Yeah, so they were going to have to take a leap of faith.
Right.
And also they're going to have to take a leap of faith in a project, which is a black project, which is about you're talking against the industry, you know, to a certain extent.
Right.
So agents are going to say, no, mm-hmm. You're not going to do that. You're going to alienate your audience.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So,
for sure.
So people don't speak out because it's not the right thing to do. So we were worried about that. I mean, yeah, I had sleepless nights over this.
Yeah.
You know, and then in the office we had a left-hand wall, which was all the people that we wanted. Mm-hmm. And then we had a right-hand wall, which was full of pictures of all of all of the contributors that was our wish list.
Mm.
Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you get into work in the morning, you're like, okay, these are all the people that we want. You look at the other wall was blank. Okay, and you start thinking, right, who's going to be the first one? Is anyone going to come through?
Yeah.
And, you know, it was an amazing journey to see the right-hand wall lose its pictures and the left-hand wall started to fill up.
Right.
And the left-hand wall ended up with more pictures on it than the right-hand wall.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an amazing, like I said before, a project. And congratulations again. You definitely checked it out. They've Gotta Have Us on Netflix. It's a rise of black artists in film. To wrap up the interview, I want to just do a set. This is a special segment where we do fast round questions. Okay?
Sure. Okay.
So this is, I'll ask you some questions and you tell me the first thing that comes to mind, okay?
Okay. All right.
All right.
Could be dangerous.
It could be. who is someone you would like to work with?
I'm working with Ava DuVernay.
Hey, yeah. Yes. Love that. What is your favorite word?
It's French, formidable.
And what does that mean?
It means fantastic, amazing.
Oh, okay.
Like, yeah, it's like there is no literal translation for it in English.
How many languages do you speak?
I speak Portuguese fluently.
Nice.
I speak a little bit of Spanish, French, and a little bit of Italian.
That's amazing.
I live in Europe.
Yeah, right?
I'm a European
it's
black
everywhere.
Man.
Yeah. What's your least favorite word?
No.
No, okay. What's something that turns you on?
That I told you is a dangerous question. intelligence.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Perfect. Something that turns you off?
Stupidity.
Mm, I agree with that one. Yeah. What's a sound or noise that you love?
Oh, sound or noise that I love. I don't know. That's a difficult one.
Yeah.
Sweet sound of a clarinet.
Clarinet?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is a sound or noise that you hate?
When people like the sound of chalk on a blackboard.
Oh,
yeah.
brings back memories.
Yeah.
What profession other than your own would you like to participate in?
Do you know, it's I always loved that film Hitch with Will Smith.
Yeah,
I would love to have been Hitch.
Oh, okay, like
some kind
romance therapist. And last but not least, heaven exists, you get up to God. What would you like to him say to you?
What would I like God to say to me? Would you like to go back down and try again?
I think that's the first time I ever had that response. That was amazing. Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure having
you
on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for joining me in the studio. Folks, thank you for watching. Go ahead and like, subscribe. Also, shout out to Kevin Undergaro and Maria Menounos for allowing me to bring these amazing guests in every week and share their stories. And also, you can check out season one of Inside the Black Actors Studio on www.theonchannel.com. You can go ahead and stream that. And Simon, go ahead and tell everyone where to find you on social media.
Yeah, okay. Sure. So on Twitter, you can find me at Artist Simon F. On Instagram, I am Simon Frederick, both words together. And I don't really do Facebook.
So, yeah.
But yeah, please hit me up.
Yes.
Tell me what you think of the show. Watch the show. Tweet the show, you know, share the show with your friends. But above all, tell me what you think.
Yes, yeah. For sure. And then we'll have a link to the show at the bottom of this episode as well. I'm definitely going to go watch all of it now because
okay.
They've got to have us because they do. They got to have us.
They really do. We have to have ourselves too.
We have to have ourselves too. I love that. That's somewhere. And then you can find me everywhere at I Am Danny Royce. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Same place, same time, inside the Black Actors Studio. Stay blessed.
On behalf of our BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to Black Hollywood Live, the world's first digital broadcast network devoted entirely to urban entertainment and pop culture. Check out our Black Hollywood Live YouTube page for even more great programming and amazing content. And be sure to subscribe and like our channel when you do. I'm your BHL host, Nakia Monet, and you can find me on all social media at Kiki Boom Boom or at Black Hollywood Live. Black Hollywood Live, Hollywood redefined.